Part 2. Is this the end of ISKCON? In my country, in Argentina, maybe in other countries as well, they say regarding movies mostly, like, part 2s are never as good as part 1s. I'm doing a part 2 for whatever it's worth, and yeah, trying to continue contributing to the ongoing conversation. And probably part 2 will be the last part. I'm doing it because of many reasons, one of those being I've been invited by different friends, brothers and sisters from within ISKCON, from within the fringes of ISKCON, outside of ISKCON, to share some further thoughts as a result of further conversations. So I will. But also, I personally also think that there is a place for silence. And at certain point, silence has its own volume beyond words. So probably after this, silence will be the best option and it will carry its own weight. For example, in this connection, the female Diksha Guru debate, quote-unquote debate, for me, because for me the very fact that there is a debate about it is in itself absurd, preposterous. Mm-hmm. It's like making a debate, as we already talked, making a debate whether women could be lawyers, doctors, mothers, or whatever. No, there is no point to the debate and to itself. The fact that there is a debate in itself is pointed to something else. As I say, this is a tip of the iceberg. So, anyhow, it's good to know when to enter silence. It's good to know when to open our mouth and say something, or try at least to try to know, and try to embody the ideal spirit of what we want to represent, rather than just criticizing, of course, how others do things in ways that I disagree with. Because I'm here, I'm not trying to point to that direction, not to be a passive consumer of something without doing anything, and in the way of context of that being seeing ourselves compromising our ideals, nor to become cynical and be a stone thrower from the outside, and that's our only contribution, quote unquote. So the spirit of my presentation today hopefully is a middle path, which I hope always is my hope to do with every presentation I do, especially with delicate topics. Like, may seem like it's about criticism, it's about taking advantage of any given situation to gain likes and followers and attention. But hopefully not. Hopefully it's about not so much, again, pointing to a person, pointing to a group, pointing to an institution, and then stigmatizing them, crucifying them, scapegoating them so we don't have to deal with our own unresolved stuff. But hopefully sharing some thoughts, not only in an impartial way, but also in ways that commit ourselves to do our part, what's me to do, what's mine to do in this particular situation, and trying to bring a bigger picture. And then, yeah, then probably entering silence and walking my talk in my own life, supporting whatever we may say from our mouth out in how we walk life on a daily basis. And speaking about my own life, I think also another reason why I'm here opening my mouth yet still, another reason why I'm doing this is that I feel I have a duty to do that. Not only because, oh, I'm a public figure, I'm a sannyasi, blah, 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 but because I have a duty because of the privileges that I have received in my life. And many of, or if not most of those privileges are especially connected to those coming from many privations, losses, and even betrayals that I've gone through in my journey. So that's for me an interesting sequence. I have a duty because I have privileges, and those privileges come from privation, loss, and betrayal. Again, I've been deprived in many ways. I don't want not to play the victim, but just how life happens, and to all of us in one way or another, we all experience betrayal, being ostracized, scapegoat, whatever, being an outsider. But those privations actually became privileges. As traumatizing, as painful as they were, they eventually blossom as privileges. The privilege of being an outsider. The privilege of belonging to the rejected class, to the ghetto. Now, that gives you a unique perspective of things. You gain a viewpoint that nobody else can gain, of inhabiting liminal space. And all that offers a very unique, not only experience of life, the only perspective to see things from that particular picture. I'm also being an outsider, being an outcast, if you will, in many ways. gives you the freedom of saying what you want to say without the fear of being kicked out from anyone, because you've already been kicked out. And experience a deep belonging many times outside of that quote-unquote previous belonging. So from all that, from all those privileges coming from deprivation and loss and betrayal, at least in my opinion, it creates for me a duty, sacred responsibility, responsibility meaning the ability to respond to any given situation. So I hope I'm talking from that side today, and not only today. And also, as I said in part one of this video, of this series, quote-unquote, that probably will end up with the second part, I will try to emphasize today the complexity of situations like this one. No, it's not just one thing happening, one person who is making the whole mistakes, one single solution. There's not only one problem, but as I said in part one, a multi-layered polycrisis. And therefore, solutions to complex problems require, to begin with, an acknowledgement, to begin with, of the fact that we have a problem, and then of the fact that the problems may be complex, the complexity of the problem. As I say, foreground versus background. Gain a background, and not only getting obsessed with the foreground, what's going on right in my face, by zooming out and seeing the bigger picture and all the other details and influences playing out in this any given situation. Also, as I said in part one of my series, again, a series, quote-unquote, it's just a two-part video series. While I'm not institutionally affiliated with ISKCON, my two former Vaishnav gurus were all Prabhupada disciples, both of them are. And therefore, in one sense, I'm as a grandchild of Srila Prabhupada as any other ISKCON grandchild of Prabhupada. No. So from that place, I feel a call to share my thoughts on this connection. And above that, again, as I mentioned, ISKCON for me is not merely an institution. Actually, the institutional side of ISKCON is the most external one of all the other dimensions and layers of it. That's the institutional part, which I'm not condemning, I'm not downplaying, but it's the outer shell of an internal and eternal essence. So while the shell has a purpose, sometimes the shell may be cracking. Or to follow another analogy, the snake may be ready to shed an old skin, to embrace a new one, not to die. In the same way, the inner substance of ISKCON, despite whatever may be happening on the shell level, the inner substance of what ISKCON is about actually remains alive, always. It's alive, it's ever-evolving, remains untouched by externalities, happening on the relative plane that need to be addressed, but with the understanding that the essence is never compromised. So whatever I will be trying to share today, again, is in the spirit also of complementing what many other various thoughtful Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis in the community have been sharing already. So I may not go, before of that, I may not go and repeat what they have shared. There are many important points, not because they are not important, but just because I try to just bring some other points in complement to theirs, in service to theirs. And I also acknowledge, of course, I'm not naive enough to think everyone agrees with me, as it was clear from the comment section of part one, and probably from the comment section of part two. And I also want to acknowledge that there are sincere devotees, practitioners who may read this situation, may read scripture, may read the tradition, in different ways and arrive at different conclusions than the ones I'm arriving, though I don't like to call those conclusions. It's always like to leave the door open. But again, my intention here is not to question the integrity of certain people I may disagree with, but by actually to normalize disagreement as part of any conversation, as part of unity and diversity. And while we acknowledge disagreement, hopefully we can express our differences of opinion with respect, with maturity, and again, with that hope, hopefully it's not a naive hope, I'm leaving the comment section open for this video, and for any video basically I publish, to foster a sense of community and dialogue, and ultimately there are no taboo topics, and we can all sit at the same round table, all at the same distance from the center, and share as openly and vulnerably as we can. So, before going to the main theme, one brief clarification related to the previous one and this one, in terms of thumbnail, because some people may have thought, okay, your thumbnail is too clickbaity, and therefore I won't look at your video, you just want to gather attention and likes and people following. And to be honest, in one sense, you could say, yeah, this is clickbait. It's trying to attract your attention. But what's the problem with trying to attract someone's attention? No, most of us do. I mean, if you publish a book, you will try to make a very nice cover so it draws the attention of people so they can read it, because you want them to read it so they can be benefited, hopefully, by it. Or if you are giving a lecture at a very important place, you may present yourself in a nice way, trying to draw some attention, trying to create some impression, not because you're an evil-minded person trying to manipulate your audience, but just trying to adjust the packaging to better convey your message. So for me, the intention of the thumbnail was, attracting attention, but with the intention of conveying a message that was true to what the thumbnail announced. I was not lying. The question was, is this the end of ISKCON? I didn't say this is the end of ISKCON. Is this the end of ISKCON? It's an open question, and it's a question that many members from ISKCON, inside, outside, have been asking. So basically, I tried to give voice to something that was already happening in the inside of many people. And there was fire around, The fire doesn't mean the whole thing is burning down, even if it may need to, I don't know. But fire is a sign of burning down, of course, but also of light, of warmth, of transformation. So even so-called burning down and death is a part of transformation cycle. So there was never any other intention beyond that, trying to, capture attention, but with the intention of conveying a particular content that was reflected in the title of the YouTube video, in the content of the thumbnail, and this is the same case with part two. So for me, the title, again, is to normalize questions that we may need to voice, normalize cycles in nature, in life, of being born, sustaining, dying, shedding skin. And also emphasizing, many times if I say, is this the end of we don't like the question, many times it's because we humans are not very good with endings. We don't do that well with closure many times. So it's important. And if we get triggered by that, it's a good invitation for us to ask why I'm being triggered. So again, what I'm sharing is not about ISKCON in one sense exclusively, but we are using, so to say, with respect and honor, we are addressing that particular template, this particular current situation, to see many other scenarios that similarly may take place in other places like family, group, communities, power dynamics, relationship. Again, we are all in some of that. We are all in relationships. We all belong to some community, to some family, to some group. And there we will find power dynamics. We will find sometimes fear, intimidation as motivators, ulterior motives. We may find over-idealization of role models, references, authorities. We will find innocent naivety and whatnot playing out everywhere. Again, not only in one spiritual group, not only in ISKCON. So I think part of solving this particular issue, at least part of it, is normalizing this and universalizing these patterns. It's not just about ISKCON, about this female Diksha Guru thing. One is solved, everything is solved. Now, beyond this specific example, again, if we can see that's playing out in so many other ways. If we zoom in too much into this particular situation, any given situation, we may lose sight how many other similar patterns and situations and things are already taking place in our own lives, and we may not be addressing them because we just concentrate on ISKCON and let's speak strongly in that direction, and we are neglecting our own duty at home, so to say. So just a note of sobriety in this direction. So that said, a recent letter has been published, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, by ISKCON's GBC, which has created a lot of turmoil, at least in big part of the community, what I could see. I've been contacted by some of them, especially, again, by those affiliated officially as institutional members of ISKCON within the ISKCON institution, but also beyond it. Because this concerns, again, the whole Gaudiya Vaishnava, broader Gaudiya Vaishnava community and beyond. I won't read the whole letter now, but I will focus on its main points. The beginning of the letter is many lines of whereas. With all respect, I'm skipping those, since I feel that the real thing, which is the resolution, comes after that. And the resolution reads as follows. There are like five resolutions. There should be an ongoing discussion on Guru Tattva based on Srila Prabhupada's teachings and examples amongst qualified devotees in ISKCON. Details can be discussed further. There should be a system to give more recognition and spiritual authority to certain qualified Siksha Gurus within ISKCON. Qualified Vaishnavis or Vaishnavas can be recognized as these special Siksha Gurus. Until the issue is satisfactorily resolved concerning Vaishnavi Diksha Gurus, qualified Vaishnavis should only be recognized as Siksha Gurus, with the exception of Narayani Devidasi, who remains the Diksha Guru of her current disciples. The present committee remains open to assist in further research and discussions on the topic according to the GVC's desire. So, okay, that's the resolution. And probably you already know why, why so many people feel angry or sad or betrayed, unseen, neglected, or treated in an infantilized or infantilizing way, with all respect to those who crafted this letter, but in many ways, it feels like written to a child. And even beyond that, what do I mean by this? That the resolution says something, but they do not explain why they reached that resolution. I mean, for the time being, Vaishnavi Diksha Gurus, for example, Vaishnavis cannot act as if Vaishnavi Diksha Gurus. So naturally, the question for sure after that will be, why? But there is no explanation as to why. So it makes me think, like, I don't know, me being a child, and my father telling me, I don't know, don't put your finger on the socket, on the plug. And if I do not know, I will ask why. And if he doesn't tell me why, probably I will end up doing it. It will create some distortion in me, some confusion. So I feel that in some way, with all respect, but this letter is not written in a mature way, and it's not, how to say, it's not making the readers feel that they are being addressed as mature human beings with criteria and with genuine questions as to why you've reached a resolution. Generally, ideally, if you want to live in a transparent, open, loving society based on trust and confidence, as Prabhupada hoped for ISKCON, you will try to be as clear and transparent with your resolutions, your thought process to reach those resolutions and to explain why you reached those resolutions, and so on and so forth. So there are a few issues for me personally in connection with this letter beyond of what I already said. Of course, that Vaishnavis are not allowed to give Diksha by the fact that they are women, basically. That's an issue, not only for me, of course. Because again, so far no actual explanation is provided as to why a Vaishnavi cannot serve as Gurvi, which will be the female form of Guru. The fact that we have a female form for Guru, Gurvi, means that that's a possibility. So far the only reason we can assume is, okay, a female-bodied Vaishnavi cannot give Diksha because she is a female-bodied Vaishnavi. As long as there is no more specific explanation, that's the only conclusion you can take, which, as we will see, contradicts the very basic common sense ABC essence of what Guru Tattva is. Of course, the tone of the presentation is, again, overextending a conversation that has already been taking place for decades, right? Okay, we need to think more about this situation of female Diksha Gurus, but they have been talking about this for decades. And to just say we need more time, we need a few more months, a few more years, again, sounds a little bit, with all respect, immature, childish, or hoping that your audience will be childish enough, naive enough to say, okay, yeah, we can wait, no problem. So to be honest, for me, this kind of pushing and delaying feels like a very formal way of saying something rather than sharing the actual reasons behind the curtain as to why this stance has been taken. You know? So for me, it's more like, okay, be courageous, with all respect, be honest and transparent, and say directly why you are actually saying this. Whatever that may be, and we will analyze some of those possibilities we have done in part one. But to just do zigzag around it, and we will need some time to think more about it. I mean, I totally understand that sometimes complex issues require time to think about it and talk about it. But sometimes some issues are quite clear. In my opinion, this is one of those. So in the context, again, of trying to justify, in my opinion, or to explain these points, very strange apocedantic notions are being brought here, such as differentiating between siksha and diksha. Of course, those are two different functions of the same guru tattva department, but to say a Vaishnavi can act as a siksha guru but not as diksha, you are like creating a binary, a fragmentation. You're fracturing the akanda guru tattva. Akanda means non-divided, undivided, unfragmented. So by saying you can be a siksha but not a diksha, in itself that shows that we are not having a proper conception of the non-difference, the difference but non-difference also between siksha and diksha. It's two different functions of the same department, of the same role of service. And then coming this new created category for women, not for all women, but for some women, of being a special siksha guru. Which again, that's already siksha guru is special. As someone said online, that sounds kind of like they are trying to give some form of consolation prize, right? Okay, ladies, sorry, so far you cannot act as female diksha gurus, but you can be labeled as special siksha gurus. Which again, for me, it smells like there is something else behind. And we have to be honest and courageous in speaking about that. That's what will make our community develop faith and trust in us as transparent being mediums of representatives of the divine. That's how Prabhupada will describe a guru. And also, one other strange situation, of course, connected to all this, is that not allowing Vaishnavis, or in this case only one Vaishnavi, Narayani Devi, to continue accepting disciples. Like, you have been allowed to do that, but you are not, cannot do that anymore because we have changed our minds. A guru is subject to what someone else is saying. When you can give initiation, we can stop giving initiation. You can keep the ones you already have, basically, but no more than that. Again, for me, with all respect, I'm trying to base my opinions on what Shastra teaches. This is awkward. Again, for me, to begin with, nobody can tell you who is your guru and who is your disciple. No, it's not something that can be sorted in a committee, in protocol, through bureaucracies, through a particular letter and an agency. That's a very personal and intimate transaction. If we study the history of many Gaudiya Vaishnava interaction, like, I don't know, Lokanath Swami, Narottam Das Thakur, and Lokanath Swami making a vow, I won't have disciples, but by the natural dedication of Narottam, he breaks his vow and accepts him. I'm not saying this has to be always the same pattern, but these are the types of natural, spontaneous flow and interaction of affection that even takes people to change their mind, conquered by heart. Mm-hmm. So that's a very personal, intimate transaction. And no committee, with all respect, no GVC, nor institution can nor should micromanage that or try to control that. Mm-hmm. That belongs to the market of faith. Okay? Faith alone is the currency there. Guru and disciple, the currency is faith. Deep trust. Not what some anonymous committee with people inside, but we don't know who are they, concludes about. And of course, again, in a situation like this, it's easy to get angry at ISKCON. But interestingly enough, those who get angry at are also, most of them who are angry are also ISKCON. So again, what's ISKCON, right? Who is ISKCON? Yes, ISKCON is those who are angry as well as those who are being the object of others' anger. And all of them, probably many of them, are inside under the umbrella of the ISKCON institution. And they may be in the same institution, ISKCON in this case, but probably these two will feel worlds apart from each other in different planetary systems in how they choose to be members of ISKCON. Like once a friend of mine told me, there is ISKCON and there is my ISKCON. So many times this happens also. We may be part of the same institution or the same tradition, but we may feel an abyss between one another in how we live the tradition. And we may feel closer to people from other traditions or sister traditions, other institutions. As I was talking a few days ago, with a friend, a rabbi, Nahum Ward Lev, close friend of mine, and we were talking how we feel very close to each other, like kindred spirits, though he's from the Jewish tradition and I'm Gaudiya Vaishnav. But at the same time, he thought of another way of membership and fellowship. He thought, reminding something that Richard Rohr said, Many people inhabit the center of their tradition, and many live in the edge of the inside. So they are close enough to what's going out outside, so they are informed by other voices and by variety and diversity. So I say, yeah, I personally inhabit the edge of the inside of my tradition. My friends say, I personally think I'm inhabiting the edge of the outside of my tradition. But still, both of us are close enough to the edge. And that makes us be closer enough from each other than how close we may be from those of our same tradition that are very much in the center of the tradition while we are inhabiting near the edge. And again, when we are too much in the center, we have the risk of losing sight of bigger pictures, of being informed by other voices. No, that's another point. Some people come into my first video, when I listened that you were not a member of ISKCON, I stopped listening. But again, even if you choose to consider me an outsider of ISKCON, which I don't think so, and I try to explain that in part one, every group needs the input from outsiders. We need to be nourished and gain perspective and feedback from outsiders. If not, we become our own only sole point of reference. And that's the beginning of a cult. That's a very cultish, self-referential, almost narcissistic way of thinking. So again, people from ISKCON are angry at other people from ISKCON. So who is ISKCON? What's ISKCON? Probably more than ever, the question of what it means to be part of ISKCON is more relevant now than ever. What is ISKCON? What does it mean to belong to ISKCON, to be part? How to participate? And there may be different answers to that question. And everyone has to find theirs. And again, as I said, if we over-identify this problem with ISKCON, this is only about ISKCON, we may miss the problem when that same problem happens somewhere else, as I say, at home, in my own religious institution, in my own relationships. So there's no need to scapegoat ISKCON. Again, I'm not here on a case against ISKCON or even against the GBC or against an individual. This is a human problem, again, right? Behind ISKCON, behind any institution, there are individuals and humans with their own limitations and flaws, right? Let's not over-romanticize, over-idealize. Maybe all this is necessary for that to happen. Certain individuals who think and who act in certain ways, motivated by certain factors. For me, four types of people come to mind involved primarily in this particular situation. Of course, there may be more. Feel free to share your thoughts. But four main type of people, again, it's not just one type of people and that creates this particular mess or issue. Four come to mind. One is those who actually do not know the Siddhanta at all on Guru Tattva. In an innocent way, naive way, they do not know. And they think, okay, yeah, men are the only ones supposed to be gurus, whatever. Those are one. There may be the minority, who knows. Then the second group will be those who know the Siddhanta, at least to some degree, but at the same time bring some cultural baggage with them. And probably a lot of Indian cultural baggage or ideas of what it means, Vedic culture, cultural baggage. So their understanding of Siddhanta and Guru Tattva gets filtered with some of these sensibilities. We briefly address some of that in the part one of this series. A third group will be those who know the Siddhanta on Guru Tattva, and those who have no cultural baggage of this type, but who have ulterior motives. And because of those ulterior motives, they compromise, basically, their integrity and authenticity, and they support a cause that they actually do not agree with. And we'll try to analyze each of them in a minute. That will be the rest of this presentation. But the fourth group that comes to my mind, and many may be in this group, are those who know the Siddhanta and Guru Tattva. I know that there is no actual reason to say women cannot be gurus. So those who know the Siddhanta, those who are not carrying this heavy cultural baggage that makes us filter Siddhanta through it, and those who have no ulterior motives, at least to some degree, but who are too afraid to step out due to various reasons, probably due to infantilized ideas about what ISKCON is. And Prabhupada say, this ISKCON, this institution, and I have to be loyal, I cannot never leave. If I take a stance as a female Vaishnavi who have aspiring disciples and they need my shelter, if I do that, I'm betraying my guru, and Prabhupada will be angry with me. And if Prabhupada is angry with me, Krishna will be angry with me. And if that happens to be the case, I won't be going back to Godhead in this lifetime. I will be chastised, who knows how, and so on and so forth, right? All these sequence of fear, intimidation, even neurosis that paralyzes us and freezes us. And we may end up complying and remaining passive witnesses of things that we may need be called to take action upon. So those are the four types of people I'm thinking of. Those who do not know the Siddhanta at all about Guru Tattva, innocently, naively. Those who know the Siddhanta to some degree but bring some cultural baggage in them, especially Indian Vedic culture stuff. Those who know the Siddhanta and have no cultural baggage but have ulterior motives, position, fame, name, whatever. And those who know the Siddhanta have no cultural baggage, have no ulterior motives of these types, but are too afraid for different reasons to step out. And of course, there are all the other possible combinations of the above four in two different degrees, right? So let's explore a little bit each one of these four patterns. And again, I'm not black and white saying each, there are different people and this belong to box one, two, three. I don't want to compartmentalize individuals. We may all have a mixture of each one of these. So let's go to those who do not know the Siddhanta and Guru Tattva. In this particular case, there are many Siddhantas inside the Siddhanta of Guru Tattva. But let's make it simple regarding this particular issue. Female Diksha Guru and so on. A basic simple point on Guru Tattva. A guru is not based on gender or on any external consideration. A guru is based on internal adhikar, eligibility qualification for that. I quote in the previous lecture, part one, different verse from the Gita, from the Bhagavad, and from the Upanishad saying basically the same thing. Guru has to have inner realization, knowledge of Shastra, control senses, balance humanity. And from that place, there you have a bona fide mentor, guide. Never we will hear, it has to be a man. No, it has to be this, it has to be that. So again, here the issue is not progressive versus conservative for me, nor East versus West. The issue is this, if adhikar is the criterion in Shastra, if eligibility is the criterion in the scripture, then to categorically disqualify someone merely based on embodiment alone, that's not caution, that's theological inconsistency that goes directly against Shastra, scripture. And Srila Prabhupada himself, because Srila Prabhupada is one of the main persons, if not the main person invoked by those who defend the idea of women not being gurus, Prabhupada himself emphasizes Shastra as the foundation, not even guru as the main foundation. Shastra, again, is very clear about the qualifications of a guru. What Prabhupada says, this is coming from the purport of Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila, chapter 20, verse 352, very well-known, important purport. He says, one should accept a thing as genuine by studying the words of saintly people, spiritual master, and the Shastra, right? Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. The actual center is the Shastra, the revealed scripture. If a spiritual master does not speak according to the revealed scripture, he is not to be accepted. Similarly, if a saintly person does not speak according to the Shastra, he is not a saintly person. The Shastra is the center for all. Unfortunately, Prabhupada laments, at the present moment, that's still current, people do not refer to the Shastras. Or even if they do, I will argue, they do it out of context with very rare, obscure, and unsubstantial evidence. So we'll go in a minute. Of course, I already mentioned some Shastric quotations, and I think there are more than enough. When scriptures speak about guru, you have the clear qualifications that made someone prepare for that post. And we never will read woman cannot, men should, and so on. But let's go first of all to our Ishtadev, the Ishtadev of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. Krishna acting as an acharya. We're discussing Guru Tattva, right? Okay, here we have God as a guru. Okay, Krishna coming as an acharya, Sri Chaitanya Dev Mahaprabhu. So regarding who can be a guru, and sometimes again, no, woman cannot be guru because they have to be Brahmins to wear the thread and to give the thread to others and so on and so forth. Again, relative considerations, in my opinion. And Mahaprabhu makes that clear when he's talking with Ramananda Roy. Kiva bi prakiva nyasi sudra kene nai, hey Krishna tattavetas, hey guru hai. Mahaprabhu is saying that to Ramananda Roy. Get the context here. Ramananda Sambhad, this conversation Mahaprabhu is a born Brahmin and sannyasi, and he's speaking with Ramananda Roy, who is considered on the social class definition, like a sudra working for the government. So, and he's taking lessons from him, which is, again, totally counterintuitive for how people at the time will think socially. No? A sannyasi is not supposed to mix with a non-sannyasi and a Brahmin speaking, what to speak of speaking, taking lessons and embracing him ecstatically, Ramananda Roy. So in that context, Mahaprabhu is saying, Kiva Bipra, first he's going to Brahmins, not neglecting that. It doesn't matter if you're a Brahmin, whether you're a Brahmin, Kiva Bipra, Kiva Nyasi, Sannyasi, he's both Brahmin and Sannyasi. So he's kind of explaining his own situation. I'm a Sannyasi and I'm a Brahmin and I'm taking lessons. Kiva Bipra, Kiva Nyasi, Sudra. I'm taking lessons from a Sudra, at least how you can see it from the outside. Krishna Tattva Vedta Se Guru. If you know Krishna Tattva, the reality of Krishna, the truth about Krishna, you are Guru. That's basically Mahaprabhu saying that to Ramananda Roy himself. And of course, that's not limited to Ramananda. So Mahaprabhu came to break those strict, rigid ideas. He himself said, Naham viprana chana rapatrna piva isunasudro naham varninicha grihapatir novanas jovanavana jovanas toyatirba. Sorry. So he's saying, beginning, Naham Bipra, I'm not a Brahmin. And he's rejecting all these relative designations. He still is a Brahmin, and he still acted as a sannyasi, but on a deeper level, he said, Yatirba, I'm not a sannyasi. So there is a relative superficial consideration, and there is a substantial one. And when we are speaking about qualifications for a guru, we have to go deep to the substantial one. There are a few beautiful words that I read the other day, actually, from Srila Siddhar Maharaj, Srila Bhaktirakak Siddhartha Goswami Maharaj, coming from his famous, beautiful book, Sri Guru and His Grace, when he's explaining this verse, Kiva Bipra Kiva Nyasi Sudra Kenenaya, a very important one. So allow me to read this from you, for you. He says, we are slaves of the truth. We are beggars for the pure current of truth that is constantly flowing, the fresh current. We are not charmed by any formality. I will bow down my head wherever I find the river of nectar coming down to me. When one is conscious that the absolute truth is descending to him from the highest domain, he, she, one will think, I must surrender myself there. Again, no matter from where, male, female, sudra, but he's explaining this verse, right? Wherever the truth appears, wherever the nectar of divine ecstasy descends, I shall offer myself as a slave. That is my direct concern. Whatever form it takes doesn't matter much. The form has some value, but if there is any conflict, the inner spirit of a thing should be given immense value over its external cover. Otherwise, if the spirit has gone away and the bodily connection gets the upper hand, our so-called spiritual life becomes sahaja, a cheap imitation. So I don't think you need me to make the parallels of how this applies to the female Diksha Guru issue. But it is very clear. This is spoken by Srila Siddhar Maharaj, who, by the way, Srila Prabhupada considered as his Siksha Guru. So if you love Prabhupada, you also please pay attention to someone that Prabhupada pay attention to. And for me, this verse, and this explanation of this verse, Kiva Bipra Kiva Nyasi Sudra Kenenaya, also beautifully reminds me of a very important verse composed by Rupa Goswami, quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavitamati Kriyatam Jadi Kutopi Labhyate Tatra laulam api kalam mulyam janmakoti sukritar nalabhyate. This is a very important verse which describes Krishna Bhakti Rasa. Whatever you find, in whatever circumstance you find Krishna Bhakti Rasa, go and get there. No matter the form, no matter the person, no matter the group, no matter the institution, whatever that's available, laulam, be greedy for that. We have to paint in coins of greed. And interestingly enough, Srila Prabhupada said once, I became inspired to name my society, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, based on this verse by Rupa Goswami. So the whole ISKCON, the name of ISKCON is an abbreviation, acronym for International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And the inspiration for that name comes from this verse. And this verse's essence is whatever and no matter the form in which divine love manifests, be greedy for that and go for that. And the implications of that is whether it takes a female form, a male form, in one institution or the other, in my tradition or sister traditions, be an saragrahi, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, be an essence seeker. So again, in my opinion, by saying women cannot be gurus because they are women, so far that's the only explanation we've received, we are creating an apasampradaya. At least those who say that and think like that, they are participating in an apasampradayic current. Or in Srila Siddharmarasa's word, this, again, when we, he says, if the spirit has gone away and the bodily connection gets the upper hand, your female body, our so-called spiritual life becomes sahaja, a cheap imitation. So we are creating apasampradaya, we're creating sahaja, we are going against the very verse, this verse that I just quoted, that inspires Srila Prabhupada to name his society as ISKCON, and we are doing all that in the name of ISKCON. So that's sad. That's embarrassing, I will say. That's cringy. That's preposterous, with all respect and all affection. So I was referring to Mahaprabhu, the Ishtadeva of our Sampradaya. Let me refer to him for a minute more. He will give position to woman. Madhavi Devi was one of his four intimate associates with whom he will discuss intimately Rasakatha. There's this famous Leela where Mahaprabhu is looking at Jagannath and a lady climbs off his shoulders. and eventually his associates take the lady down. But Mahaprabhu sees her and says, if I only will have the longing she had. He never says, oh, what are you doing, woman climbing on my shoulder? I'm a man, I'm a sannyasi, you have polluted me. He was longing for her longing. And ultimately, again, Mahaprabhu himself is the final confirmation, or Ishtadev is the final confirmation of the sacred feminine and the role of it. Because who is Mahaprabhu? Gaur Sundar, Gaur Hari? He's Krishna worshipping Radha. That's his sannyas name. Krishna Chaitanya means Krishna consciousness. So he's Krishna in Radha's mood, being conscious of Krishna. But the whole Gaur Leela is Krishna trying to embrace the mood of Sri Radha, trying to honor that mood, trying to be empathic, to be connected and sensitive to the divine feminine. And not only be sensitive, but worshipping that. Krishna himself in the pen of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, Radhikar Prima Guru Amishishya Natta, he says. The love of Sri Radha is my guru, Krishna says. She is my guru. Her love is my guru. She is love personified, so her love and her is the same. She is my guru, and I am a student in her dancing school. And every day I learn new dancing lessons by the power of her love. So here we have God himself saying, I am a disciple, I am a sishya, and Sri Radha is my guru. Oh, but Radha is a woman. She cannot be a female Diksha guru. Anyhow. I hope you get my point. And again, let's honor the divine. Let's not forget that. Our Ishtadev, Mahaprabhu, is God becoming a student, a sadhaka, a practitioner, a disciple of the Supreme Goddess in the most substantial way. That in itself should say a lot. Let's stay with that for a moment. And that in itself sets a big pattern for our tradition. We should bow down to the sacred feminine. Whenever, wherever, however that manifests in our lives. And we have to be very careful not to offend the sacred feminine, or to speak of diminishing it, neglecting, mistreating it, abusing it. That can carry tremendous consequences. And regarding Mahaprabhu and regarding this situation of judging guruship or gurutva by one's external form, as apasiddhantic, Srila Siddharmarash will say, referring to Mahaprabhu, and speaking of apasiddhanta, he says, apasiddhanta, or philosophical adulteration, strikes very harshly. It was Swarup Damodar's service to examine any poems or writings for purity before they were taken to Mahaprabhu. If writings with apasiddhanta were offered to Mahaprabhu, he will be very severely disturbed. Apasiddhanta cruelly attacks the ideal of the higher thinking persons. So we could see even apasiddhanta as a form of violence, basically. It's the opposite of ahimsa. And again, as I like always to say, and again, not want to create neurosis or stigmatize anyone, but apasiddhanta is the beginning of apasampradaya. And apasampradaya, that which goes against a sampradaya, sampradaya meaning a particular school of thought that delivers a certain flow of truth. So an apasampradaya begins with apasiddhanta. An apasampradaya comes from a genuine sampradaya, But because of apasiddhanta, it ends up becoming an apasampradaya. And many times, apasiddhanta is the beginning of apasampradaya. And many times, this brings aparad. Speaking about apa. Why? Because aparad means to act against love. Aparada. Radha is love personified, and apa is to go against. So apasiddhanta, to go against siddhanta, perfect conclusions. Apasampradaya, to go against the revealed natural flow of truth. Aparad, to go against love. This case is, in my opinion, and again, I use aparad from that sense, not trying to demonize anyone, but to act against the flow of love. If a female guru, if a gurvi, a Vaishnavi, is a loving Vaishnavi, speaking about love, is a loving Vaishnavi and an aspirant servant, feels love for the love of that Vaishnavi, feels lovingly attracted for the love of that Vaishnavi and would like to take shelter and diksha from that Vaishnavi, but we interfere with that love experience, we are technically engaged in aparad. We are getting in the way of love. And we know all the cautionary tales about aparad. I don't need to go there now. So in brief, being in denial, in my opinion, of a woman being potentially acting as diksha gurvis, of course, if qualified again, all that entails, being in denial of that entails apasiddhanta, apasampradaya, aparat, sahajijism, as Srila Siddha Maharaj said, and last but not least, I will say impersonalism, which are all the things that we condemn in one way as Gaudiyas, and we try to be aware of. How this is an example of impersonalism? Of course, impersonalism is not only I want to merge into Brahman, I want my Brahma Sayuja. There are worse forms than that that come as disguised as Vaishnavism. No, impersonalism, basically, I'm denying you the right of being a person. I'm not treating you as the unique, irrepeatable individual that you are. So when we say woman cannot be female gurus, woman cannot be gurus, we are putting all women in one single box called woman. We are stop addressing each individual case and studying their particular situation and eligibility. So when we speak abstractly and generically about woman as a class, without understanding that each individual is different, that's impersonalism. And again, there are different women. Some women will have different natures. Some women may feel comfortable being at home with their family. That's great. Some will feel inspired to become PhD scholars. Some will be monastics, like with every tradition. And this is, again, this is by me saying this, I'm not engaging in some contemporary woke issue. This has been there from ancient times. Again, you go to the Vedas, and you will find ancient Rishikas, which is the female for rishis, ancient seers and ladies, sages, ladies, gurvis, and so on. This is not a new contemporary wave of postmodernism of whatever. So again, apasampradaya, aparad, apasiddhanta, impersonalism, sahajism, if we are not careful, therefore, in the name of protecting the sampradaya, in the name of protecting, keeping the real thing, we risk creating the very distortion that we claim to defend. That's the ultimate irony, right? Preserving the form while weakening the living current within it. That's our task. Sorry, that's the task we need to avoid. Our task is to protect ourselves from preserving the form at the cost of the living current. So I've mentioned some examples about Mahaprabhu, our Ishtadev. I've mentioned some verses from Shastra referring to gurus in general. Let me quote a few verses from the Mahabharata. For those especially who had the big difficulty of thinking of woman as any form of gurus, what to speak of Diksha gurus? Let's put aside for a moment. Some people say women cannot be gurus of any sort, only male. All males have all the rights for all forms of guruship. Let's somehow try to, in a user-friendly way, begin to conceive women as some type of gurus. So we can at one point hopefully conclude they can perform all the functions of guru in different ways. Let's begin with the mother. And from there we can move on to other guru functions. The Mahabharata Adi Parva, 211.16. Guru Nam Chaiva Sarvisham Mata Paramaku Guruhu. Yudhisthira Maharaj speaking to Queen Kunti. And of all gurus, the mother is certainly the foremost guru. Manusmriti 2.145. Upadhyayam Dasa Charja Acharyanam Satampita. Sahasram tu pritin mata Gauravena tirichyate. A teacher or an acharya, that's the original word, of conduct, a teacher of conduct is an acharya, surpasses 10 teachers of recitation. A father surpasses 100 teachers of conduct, and a mother surpasses even 1,000 fathers in respectability. Nothing personal to all the fathers looking, watching this video. So again, these verses may not specifically speak as a Vaishnavi Diksha Gurvi, and I don't tend that by merely, as I say, I don't tend to say that by merely being born as a woman, you already have the right to be a guru, or you are already qualified to be a Gurvi. But I'm sure in these quotes, again, for those who have absolute difficulty in conceiving a woman at all, in any role whatsoever related to being a guru. And even if someone says, okay, those verses speak about the woman being a guru as a mother, but that's not diksha. Okay, that may be siksha. Or as this letter from the Jews say, okay, you can be siksha but not diksha. But again, this all makes the more sense because we are in a siksha parampara, right? So why, if we put so much emphasis in siksha, why particularly we are having this specific issue? If siksha is the most important and a woman can be a siksha guru, all the more they can be a diksha guru. Because siksha has prominence in this. Anyhow, besides Shastra, besides the numerous examples spoken by Mahaprabhu in his own life, we also have so many examples of gurvis, and hopefully you get accustomed to this word more and more, female gurus, gurvis, in our Gaudiya tradition. Not only from what's sometimes known as traditional parivars, coming from Nityananda Prabhu, Advaita Acharya, Gadadhar Pandit, and so on. We have many examples of gurus in those lineages. But even coming in the line of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. I know some of them in person. For example, Srimati Jayashri Devi, she's a disciple of Patit Pavan Goswami, who was a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. She has been an acharya. Acharya in female is also acharya. For more than 30 years so far, serving them. I've been in their ashram in Kolkata many times. Beautiful experience. She's a sannyasi. She receives sannyas from her guru. She gives sannyas to other ladies. You may call that sannyasini. I've met also recently with Prem Dhara Mataji, a disciple of Anantadas Babaji. She also serves in the role of female Diksha Gurvi. And again, in a very beautiful way, very inspiring people. Recently, I came to know that Binod Bani, who was a disciple I think Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur through Bhaktisaranga Goswami Maharaj when he went to England, and if not of Bhaktisaranga Goswami Maharaj, but whatever the case, she had a lady disciple that recently a friend of mine took a picture with. So Binod Bani, we have a Binod Bani Gaudiya Math in England, actually whole Gaudiya Math named after Binod Bani. So she also had disciples. So we have examples in our contemporary history in the lineage of Bhaktisiddhanta. And of course, some will say, okay, that's the line of Bhaktisiddhanta, but we are ISKCON, right? We are not Gaudiya Math, which in itself, that deserves a separate lecture. But to make that divide is wrong to begin with, because there's no such a thing called Gaudiya Math nowadays. Gaudiya Math is what Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta founded. But then after that, there was different divisions and different branches. And nowadays, all the missions have their own names. And all the missions that exist are branches from the original Gaudiya Math. And ISKCON is one of those branches. So if we say ISKCON and Gaudiya Math, we are putting all the branches of Gaudiya Math in one single box, which is another form of impersonalism. And we are putting ISKCON as a separate way. We are isolating ISKCON from the same tree from which all these Gaudiya Math branches are coming. ISKCON also is a Gaudiya Math branch. Separate conversation, but an important point, I think. To go into ISKCON, because someone will say, okay, those are the Gaudiya Math branches or the traditional parivars, whatever. Prabhupada, we are different here. That to think like that to begin with is complicated because you are over-isolating ISKCON and over-isolating Prabhupada from his whole lineage. That's not what he said. He always said, my movement is the movement of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. What I've given is not separate from what I received from my guru. And Prabhupada say, I want all of my disciples to become gurus. I won't repeat all the things Prabhupada say in this regard. Those have been said and shared by many other devotees. But still, some may argue, right? But why then he never appointed a Vaishnavi, a lady, as a guru? And again, this may be based on the idea that a guru can only be guru if he or she is appointed by his or her guru. Sometimes this is kind of the rationale. Well, guess what? Srila Prabhupada himself was never appointed as a guru by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, right? Does this make him less authorized? Of course not. So come on. No. Regarding why Prabhupada never did this, why never Prabhupada appointed a female Diksha guru? For me, this is what I meant last time in the first part of the series when with over-romanticizing Prabhupada. Like, oh, if Prabhupada never did something in particular, then nobody in the future can do that. Why? Not even him, Prabhupada himself can do that in a future situation. No. So again, what Prabhupada said is not the question. Many times we are Prabhupada said. The real question is, what will be Prabhupada saying now? And how we are called to embody what he will be saying. Because he's not saying that he's not physically here among us. We are, that's parampara. We are supposed to embody the voice of the previous acharyas in the current generation in a relevant and relatable way. So again, all these, many times these misconceptions are a result, in my opinion, of over-glorifying Srila Prabhupada. In one sense, we can never glorify someone like Srila Prabhupada enough. But we can indulge in over-glorification. Like saying, okay, Prabhupada is better than anyone else. Everyone else is below him. Nobody did what he did, even not his guru. Things like are untasteful. They are not proper to say. He created his own sampradaya. He's doing his own thing. He's establishing his own siddhanta. I don't think he will be happy with any of those things. So when we do that, we will say, Prabhupada created his own sampradaya. Actually, we are creating an apa sampradaya in Prabhupada's name, which is the last thing that Prabhupada wanted again. So again, this is not what Prabhupada himself taught. So we should address Prabhupada not in isolation, in a vacuum. He comes from a lineage. He has got brothers. He has a guru. There is a background. He's part of a tradition. And in that tradition, in that background, there were female Diksha gurus. There are plenty examples of them. In many lineages, they are the majority. And again, Prabhupada said, someone say again, why Prabhupada say this or didn't say that? Prabhupada say many things at different times to different people. Let's be honest about that. And not only Prabhupada. But this is part of dealing with him as a person who speaks according to time, place, and circumstance, which could make sense in many ways. Prabhupada say, we fall from Vaikuntha. Sometimes say, nobody falls from Vaikuntha. He gave statements as to bhakti being inherent and others that suggest the opposite. He said even things recently I discovered, Prabhupada said, not all the Goswamis are Nitya Siddhas, interestingly. Or not all the Goswamis, the six Goswamis, are gopis. I don't know why he said that, because he said the opposite, of course. We may never know. That will be an eternal mystery. But I'm saying this to show that he was treating every case, every situation very specifically. And again, we may never know why he said certain things, he didn't say some things, why he did something, why he didn't do some things. But that doesn't mean that we have to freeze Prabhupada to make him a museum piece and kept him in the past or just to the version we got to know personally. But we should allow Prabhupada to be all that Prabhupada can be today in the here and now for us. To be him, to be a dynamic presence unfolding in the present moment, in the here and now, through ourselves. That's our commitment in service to him and the Sampradaya. Srimad Bhagavatam will say, at times you have to be your own guru. In one sense, it implies asking in prayer, what will my guru say? What will Prabhupada say today? And then you have to say it. You have to embody it. We, all of us. And also, the fact that Srila Prabhupada didn't do something doesn't mean that he didn't want to do that thing. But maybe he couldn't do it at the time for whatever reason. To give you an example, he didn't translate certain chapters of the 10th canto because he passed. He didn't translate canto 11 and 12 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But that doesn't mean that he didn't want to do it. You follow my point? Because he didn't do it doesn't mean he didn't want to do it. The same with other scriptures. He didn't translate Brihad Bhagavatamrita. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't read Brihad Bhagavatamrita because Srila Prabhupada didn't do it. I know devotees who think like that, who say we only should read what Prabhupada translated. So the same applies with women being Diksha Gurus. And again, he said at times he wanted that. that he didn't do it appointing a specific lady for whatever reason, that doesn't mean that he didn't want that to happen. And therefore, that shouldn't be implemented in the eventually. So anyhow, a while ago, I mentioned four types of people that come to my mind in regards to this current polycrisis. But I've only addressed so far mostly the first case. Those who do not know the Siddhanta at all about Guru Tattva, or very little, and have more sentimental, partial ideas in connection to this issue of female Diksha Guru. So that said, let's go to the remaining ones, and I promise I will be way shorter than that. We are past half of the presentation. The second one that I mentioned was those who actually know the Siddhanta, at least to some degree, but who bring some cultural baggage in the name of Indian sensibilities, consciously, unconsciously, Vedic culture, ideals, or whatever. So again, for me, this is the important thing. What's the issue behind the issue? What takes some people to think women cannot be gurus? Because again, we can say they cannot be, but why? What takes you to conclude in that direction? Which are the background motivations? And there are many replies to that question, as we already tried to explain here and in part one. But one of them, in my opinion, and I say this in part one, is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur will call cultural baggage. Each one of us come to Krishna consciousness with our own filters, with our own prejudices, with our own assumptions, with our own biases. We could go here forever analyzing different forms of confirmation bias, cognitive bias, this bias, that bias. To gain awareness of that is part of our anarthanibriti process. So cultural baggage is one of them. And most specifically, as I say, I will say Indian cultural baggage. And I don't mean this for people born in India only, for those born in India for sure also, but also for those Westerners for that filter Krishna consciousness as something Indian or as something Vedic. Now this word Vedic is complicated. Especially again with when we have some romanticized notions of Vedic culture. And on that foundation, we justify women should be doing this and that, and they cannot do this or that. But when we say Vedic, well, it all depends what we mean by that. Because let's go to the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna orders Arjuna basically reject the Vedas. Please understand what I mean by this. In chapter 2, verse 45, he says, Nistray Gunya Babarjuna. He's saying the Vedas mostly deal with the three gunas. No? Karma Kanda section are mostly about Karma Kanda, three quarters of it. The Gunya Vabarjana. Become transcendental to the gunas, Krishna is saying, but basically he's saying become transcendental to the Vedas, at least to those sections of the Vedas that deal with the gunas, which are the majority of them. And most of that majority is connected to this notion of Vedic culture many times. Varna Ashram, Karma Kanda, social interactions and roles. So again, Krishna is saying here, become transcendental to that. We follow not so much the Vedas. Actually, in our daily studies, we do not read the Vedas much. Rig Veda, Atharva Veda, Sama Veda, Jayur Veda. Not even much the Upanishads. Again, most of the Vedas is Karma Kanda. That's not in our interest. We don't want to go to Swarga to relish heavenly delights. At least not officially. And if we are to select some section of the Vedas, that will be the Upanishads, of course, the most confidential, philosophical, metaphysical section. But at the same time, the essence of the Upanishads for us Gaudiya Vaishnavas is, one says, the Bhagavad Gita, called the Gita Upanishad. And the essence of the Gita, or the natural conclusion of the Gita, is at the feet of the Srimad Bhagavatam, who is the essence of all Vedanta, the essence of all Upanishads, the natural commentary on Vedanta, and so on. And for us, all of that Bhagavatam is then enacted in a very unique way in Gaur Lila by Mahaprabhu and his associates, all of which, as we have seen so far, have no problem recognizing Varna and all this stuff as relative and properly acknowledge that anyone with proper adhikar, woman, outcasts, dog eaters, anyone in the spectrum of that, anyone can be guru. Many verses in the Bhagavatam about that, many examples in Gaur Lila about that. So we find some progression in Shastra, if you will, in this sense. On one side, Vedic rules, Gita defining Varna Ashram, Bhagavatam further clarifying in certain sections, especially in Canto 7, Daivi Varna Ashram that goes beyond mere birth, but it's because it's out of qualities, and full Varnashram finding its fulfillment in bhakti, and then Gaur Lila, in one sense, Mahaprabhu discarding Varnashram, I mean, respecting on some level, but at the same time showing the relativity of it, but discarding it considerably according to the side gates of the time, and giving Krishna Prem indiscriminately to everyone, without consideration of case, position in society, sharing, and empowering his agents to do so in the same way. Remember, we belong to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. The first original preaching campaign of Gaudiya Vaishnavism was started by Nityananda Prabhu and his associates, going to the lowest of the lowest, taverns, brothels, outcasts in society. That's how the movement began. That's how the movement should continue in that same current, never regress back to externals. That's the only living way it can continue, for it to be a really living current passing through each one of us. And as for Varnashram, and I know there are lots of conversations about Varnashram, and you feel totally free to disagree with me, but I will argue, again, this is my view, there are four ashram, four varnas, but also there are subdivisions of those, and nuance and subtleties in all of those. Krishna himself belongs to the Abhira subdivision of the Vaishya community, and so on and so forth. And many of, on all this in general, not talking about Krishna here, but are based on our acquired nature, right? Our karmic momentum that makes us being born with a certain predisposition psychically, physically, and so on. So our acquired nature, try to hopefully get this point, even if you disagree with it, but our acquired nature depends on our samskaras, our previous impressions. So as time progresses and the world changes and the social dynamic changes, our acquired samskaras will be different because the environment is different. And thus our acquired nature will be different. And our sense of personality and our psychology will be different in different times and ages. So for me here, the essence of Varnashram is not just trying to put, reduce to these four boxes of Varna and Ashram and put people there, but the flexibility to accommodate one's acquired nature at any given time and place, whatever that may be, in a balanced way, in a way that one can cultivate sattva, balanced life, and from there grow and venture into transcendence. So anyhow, some thoughts regarding this second group. Those who may know a little bit more, the better the Siddhanta of Guru Tattva, but still carry some cultural baggage. Let's go to the third group. I'm being shorter, as I promise. Those who know Siddhanta on Guru Tattva, those who have no cultural baggage of this type, to some degree, we all have some, but those who still have some ulterior motives, some separate agenda below the carpet, whether it is name, fame, what we call pratishta, position, secure, many times all the things are tied to security and certainty, and therefore it speaks about an insecure, fragile self. So I'm saying all this not to condemn anyone. Actually, I'm invoking fragility, vulnerability, insecurity, hopefully to understand these cases as compassionately as we can, or as I can at least. Because again, for many, my opinion of those who support this view, okay, woman cannot be Diksha Gurus, or who disagree with the view, but who remain silent while disagreeing, well, actually they should be speaking up. They are expected to be speaking up, but they do not do so by fear of losing followers, or by losing their service, by losing their role in society. Again, why there is a fear behind that? Because probably all of that is tied to a potential existential crisis. If I lose my people, my audience, my servants, or my role, my service, who am I? What's my identity? Who am I without all of that? And of course, we are still someone, but until and unless we have a deep insight into a realization of who we are as Atman, we may cling on to these upadis or designations because they provide us with a sense of identity. Without a sense of identity, we go crazy, basically. So let us be honest again, to speak up has a price. When we disagree with something, to make our voice public, to speak up may cost reputation, position, financial security, community, friends, even one sense of identity, we may need to die to a version of ourselves that was tied to all these assets, to all these perks. So this is not just abstract theology, this is existential, this is very personal. That's precisely why courage is so required, and courage becomes sacred. We need to be courageous in stepping in and bringing our voice with utter sincerity. So somehow this third type, those who know Siddhanta, those who carry not much cultural baggage, but have some ulterior motives, the third type is somehow tied with the fourth type, which is those who know the Siddhanta and Guru Tattva, who know that there's nothing against women being Diksha Gurus, who have no considerable cultural baggage nor considerable ulterior motives, but who are too afraid to step out due to many reasons, as I said, infantilized ideas about what ISKCON is, what living ISKCON could mean, how that may mean to leave Prabhupada, betray him, and that will entail Krishna disliking us, and that will entail them chastising us and us being born as a frog on the next lifetime or whatever. Believe me or not, many of us carry those kindergarten notions of Krishna consciousness. So some people, and I can understand, they're afraid of leaving ISKCON. I know Prabhupada say never leave ISKCON, work together. But again, what's ISKCON at the end of the day? So there are tight notions, and I can see how complex that may be, especially if it has been reinforced for decades. Notions of betraying Prabhupada, and therefore I'm not going back to Godhead. Or as I say, I will lose my perks. My people, my facilities, my position, my name, my reputation, all that may be, there may be a black ink stinging all that. So I'm losing my identity that I have been constructed for all this time. Many times we need that. We need to die to all that, to be born to what we need to be born. Many of us have constructed, let's be honest, an identity revolving around perks, revolving around religious perks. Public person I built, the public religious persona I built, the certain clothes I'm wearing, the markings I'm carrying, all that's kind of defining who I am, but actually that's not the case in an essential way. So again, here we see lots of fear, I personally do, in my opinion, in my perception, and concern, not only due to ulterior motives, but to infantilized beliefs. And as I said before, in the part one, some even devotees that met Prabhupada very young, they met him when they were 20 or 30, and their impression of Prabhupada at that time, they still carry how they process Prabhupada in their 20s when they are 60 or 70 or 80. They have kept that version of Prabhupada according to how they perceive him, and they still think that's the only possible Prabhupada, so to say, and the only possible ISKCON, and the only possible me in relation to all that, and so on and so forth. And again, I know this is this terror of, well, but if I'm a female Diksha and female guru, Vaishnavi who has disciples who want to take initiation from me, if I dare to step up and do that, GVC may chastise me, they may banish me, I may be kicked out from ISKCON. And that can be concerning. Again, I'm not laughing at that. I can understand. I can empathize with the fear. But at the same time, again, what's ISKCON? What it means to leave ISKCON? What it means to remain in ISKCON? I'm sure Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wanted everyone to remain in the Gaudiya Math also. And Srila Prabhupada himself originally wanted to be in the Gaudiya Math serving his guru's mission. But none of that happened, right? Gaudiya Math dismantled and everyone opened their own branch, including Srila Prabhupada. But we wouldn't criticize Srila Prabhupada for leaving Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's Gaudiya Math. You left your guru's institution, but he wanted all of you to work together. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta said the same thing. I want all of you to cooperate. So we wouldn't criticize Prabhupada. I wouldn't criticize any of Prabhupada's godbrothers for leaving Gaudiya Math and opening their new branches. I just see those branches as an extension of Gaudiya Math. And in that sense, I agree that when you call all these branches Gaudiya Math, there's a place to agree with that. So here we have a similar case. As Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta never wanted anyone to leave Gaudiya Math, but they did, and we are not criticizing them. Srila Prabhupada wanted everyone to remain in ISKCON, but in many cases it didn't happen, or it may not happen. And that doesn't mean that there is someone to blame and you are betraying your guru and so on. And that's why for me some of these new inclusions, so to say, add-ons, In initiation, vows are not so becoming. I've heard recently that apart from the four regulative principles, a fifth regulative principle has been added, which is you will never leave ISKCON. And again, from and that comes from an institutional perspective, what ISKCON means and what leaving ISKCON means. And I think, again, okay, I remain in ISKCON, but what does it mean to remain in ISKCON? We have to recalibrate all this meaning. What is ISKCON? What it means to leave ISKCON? What it means to remain in ISKCON? Remain for the wrong reasons, leave for the right reasons, remain for the right reasons, leave for the wrong reasons, as I try to analyze in my book, Radical Personalism. So if I choose to remain in ISKCON, okay, let's not do so by remaining silent to things that we know and feel they are not correct. Again, loyalty to a tradition is not measured by conformity, complacency, passive witnesshood, but by one's willingness to courageously serve the highest principles of the tradition. Even when doing so is uncomfortable, even when doing so is challenging and threatening, and sometimes even when doing so entails leaving ISKCON or being kicked out from ISKCON. I know it because my former gurus, two former gurus, both of them are, as I say, are Prabhupada disciples, but they connected with Srila Siddhar Maharaj. And at one point, they were made to leave ISKCON. They didn't leave ISKCON. They were forced to leave ISKCON because they were given a choice. Whether you continue going to Srila Siddhar Maharaj, and you have to leave ISKCON, or you stay in ISKCON and you leave Srila Siddhar Maharaj. But they went to Srila Siddhar Maharaj to begin with because Prabhupada ordered that. And when he was about to leave his body, he said, someone asked, "Whom we have to, from whom we can take siksha?" And the first name that he mentioned was Srila Siddhar Maharaj. So they were kicked out from ISKCON by following Prabhupada's instructions. That does make sense, right? But that's the point, right? By following the essence of your teacher, sometimes that entails being kicked out from a tradition. So Prabhupada's instruction and desire is females can be gurus. If by you doing that properly, you are kicked out from ISKCON, that doesn't mean you are not following Prabhupada. As with many of these personalities who chose to follow Srila Siddhar Maharaj and follow Prabhupada and Srila Siddhar Maharaj because that was Prabhupada's instruction, but the result externally was they were kicked out from ISKCON. So it's a similar situation. And again, regarding GBC, I don't want to make it too personal, but again, many times for me, there's a problem with an organ, a group, a committee like GBC, where it's relatively impersonal, that you don't know who is behind whatever letter or resolution has been taken, who agreed and who disagreed. So many times a letter may come from the GBC saying, you cannot initiate anymore, you are banished, you are banned, you have to leave, whatever. But devotees do not even know who signed that letter. Again, who is the person? I like to use the term radical personalism. We want radically personal relationships. So if I do not know who agreed or disagreed with this resolution, for example, from the letter we read today, I don't know whom to address personally. So it creates a whole environment of impersonalism again. That makes the whole thing even more impersonal. Besides the impersonalism of treating women as an abstract whole, as we already explained. And for me also, I have my own opinions, but again, this is my personal opinion with something like GBC selection. Like someone who is appointed, you claim your seat until you resign or until you die. And for me, there should be an open space for the members of this broader society to choose their leaders, so to say, and not that they choose themselves for perpetuity. I remember my friend Deva Madhav, at one point, he had the courage of sending a letter to each GBC, inviting them to to resign to their post and be open to be selected by the rest of the society. To my knowledge, nobody accepted that, but that's another conversation. But basically, that's how it happens in any genuine democracy, right? So I think it's important to recalibrate some of the things. And if someone is clinging too much to a seat, to a position, and nobody will move me from that seat until my last breath, I won't give you the keys of that, then that's speaking about something else. And again, if not, if we become too dependent and codependent on authority as mediating, in this case, okay, if the GBC says something, I have to obey because that's Prabhupada's voice revealed through me, and if I go against, I'm betraying my guru. I think that's too much. And even how we think about gurus, sometimes we may relate to gurus in a way that are disempowering and infantilizing the individual. We depend too much. We are not empowered to be ourselves, to think for ourselves. Yeah, we are conditioned souls. And of course, I'm not saying whatever comes through me is pure enlightenment, but not to the point of canceling our critical thinking and banishing the whole individual. So we are supposed to here to create thoughtful people. Like Prabhupada said, I want every one of my disciples to be thoughtful people, future genuine gurus. They have to be equipped with discernment, with experience. So anyhow, some words regarding this fourth example. Those who may know Guru Tattva, may not have too much of a cultural baggage, may have no ulterior motives, but still may have some fear and intimidation due to infantilized ideas or whatever. And as I said, there is the fifth option, which is all the possible combinations of the above four. So yes, it's complex. As I say in first part of my series, it's a complex, multi-layered polycrisis. Not to feel bad, in the sense crisis is a means turning point. So something shifting, some opportunities are coming. And again, this is not only happening in ISKCON. Again, this could happen anywhere and everywhere. So we are not aiming at ISKCON. And on top of that, again, there are many more influences that none of us can address immediately taking place at any given circumstance. And this is not an exception to that rule. And not only many influences, again, this is a very charged situation. There are many emotions, there are many feelings about this. I've read many strong comments from many devotees online and personally that they sent to me. And as I say, there's lots of anger. And behind anger, there's many times lots of sadness, a sense of betrayal, a sense of loss, liminal space, being disconcerted, uncertainty. And again, I totally understand it. I've been in my own liminal space and still I am in many ways. In this particular case, again, for me, let's be careful not to over-criticize ISKCON and lose sight of how we are called to embody the solution to the very thing we criticize. Okay, we can point and speak and criticize. Okay, what are you doing to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem? Like one of my previous teachers, again, with whom I'm no longer connected with, but still I treasure many of his teachings, and this is one of them, he will say, if you're in a situation like this, let's use this one as an example, so you see something going wrong in an institution, you have three options. One, in this case, will be you stay in ISKCON, and you try to make things better from the inside of ISKCON. Valid option. Option two, if for whatever reason that's not possible, that's no longer possible, then do your own thing as you think it will represent what ISKCON should be doing. Take responsibility and have the courage to do your own thing. If not, you start, remain there and participate and try to help from there. If not, do your own thing in the best possible way. And the third option is stop criticizing and get out of the way. But do not become a cynic throwing stones from the outside while you're doing nothing to add a positive contribution to the conversation, not walking your talk. So again, we don't want to be passive victims, but we don't want either to go to the other extreme, to be resentful cynics throwing its stone from the outside. We want to be hopefully responsible, mature human beings that act with integrity, with authenticity, without betraying ourselves nor our ideals. And courageously being willing to pay the price of what it means to embrace the truth. There's a price to speaking up, and there's a price to remain silent. So what's the price to embrace the truth at any given moment? That's the definition of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta's of humility. I quoted that in part one. To have full submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. That's humility. And we are all called to be humble, humbler than a blade of grass, Trinada Pisunichin. So yeah, this is a moment of test, a challenging moment of test. And each one of us, all of us, is invited to commit ourselves to our essential core convictions and beliefs and values and then act accordingly. Whatever that will mean for you. I'm not saying this should only take this particular shape. Whatever that will mean for you and whatever shape that will take in your particular case. the form it takes in one sense is secondary. Again, as long as we do not betray ourselves, as long as we remain surrender to the initial and crucial instruction of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Satyam Param Dimahi. That's the motto of the whole of our whole tradition, which revolves around the Bhagavatam. Satyam Param Dimahi. Let's absorb ourselves on the supreme truth. Mm-hmm. If everything else cracks, structures, reputations, roles, movements around us, inside of us, what remains and always remains is the call to absorb ourselves even deeper in the truth, in the supreme truth, Satyam Param Dimahi, and to live in such a way that our loyalty is first to the truth itself, always. Mm-hmm. We came here serving for the, looking for the truth, hopefully Atat Brahma Jignasa. That's what this life is given to us. So before asking what ISKCON will do, again, and waiting for ISKCON to do the magic while we sit eating popcorn from our sofa, from a comfort zone, that's not how it works. Again, be the change you want to see in the world. So before asking what ISKCON will do, we must ask what we will do. What is mine to do in this particular situation? And even when doing so, whatever that may be, will cost us comfort, belonging, security. Again, institutions may tremble, skins may shed, debates may rage, everything or almost everything may collapse. But the eternal invitation keeps coming, remains unchanged. Satyam Param Dimahi. Embrace the highest truth. As highest as we can conceive it, right? Embrace the highest truth and let that truth reorder us from within. So I wrote a few words to conclude my sharing today. So I like to read them directly to close this series, quote-unquote, two-part series. To speak about the future also, to give an alternative, hopefully positive future, an alternative to situations that we may feel undesirable now. What will a healthy future look like? A community where spiritual authority flows from realized character, not from bodily designation. Where institutional structures serve relationships rather than micromanage them. Where we are not afraid, truth, because we are given the freedom to be ourselves. And we know we are already loved and accepted for who we are. That vision is not utopian. It is already present wherever sincerity and courage meet. And if that vision is already quietly alive among us, then our task is not to manufacture it, but to protect and embody it. In these tender moments of confusion, pain, necessary grief and grieving, deconstruction and uncertainty, I pray that we may remain united in our shared call for truth, open and courageous enough to embrace it in whatever form or unexpected way it chooses to knock on our door. May we allow the truth, rather than fear, insecurity or convenience, to steady our hearts and clarify our conscience. And may we not lose hope, please. That sacred capacity, hope, that sacred capacity to imagine a future not fully determined by the wounds of the past, nor the messiness of the present. Remembering that we are held within a story larger than this moment, and that the author of that story is still at work. Thank you so much for your time, for your attention, for your contribution, for your prayers, and may we all continue walking this sacred journey together. Hare Krishna.